This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. Glad to have you listening today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Fake news is becoming more and more problematic today. We've had the recent expose by Project Veritas of CNN staff openly speaking about their network being propaganda for the left. That caused James O'Keefe to be booted from Twitter, as many big tech companies are increasingly canceling any political views they don't like. The extreme bias in so much of the media is being exposed more and more. And this is driving many readers, viewers, and listeners to alternative news sources, such as The Trumpet. Another that you may be familiar with is the Epoch Times. This is an international newspaper and media company. It was founded in America in 2000 by Chinese Americans in response to censorship of the press in China. And it has grown really to impressive proportions. The company is fiercely critical of the Chinese Communist Party. And last week, its offices in Hong Kong were attacked. Four people came in and smashed up their equipment and temporarily shut operations down. Last Friday, I spoke with the Epoch Times' senior editor on China News, Dr. Dana Cheng, about this incident in Hong Kong. Dr. Cheng grew up in China, but she came to the U.S. on a full scholarship for a PhD program in physics. She's worked with the Epoch Times from the beginning in 2000 and has led the China News Reporting Department for 15 years now. In our interview, we spoke about China's approach toward the press and why the Epoch Times was founded, the difficulties and the pressures that they've experienced in trying to maintain an independent voice. And she really has an important message to Americans about the dangers of communism and the Chinese Communist Party in particular that you will want to hear. Now, related to that, we have a report on today's show from Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about the end of the rule of the Castros in communist Cuba. Last week, Raul Castro retired as leader of Cuba. And we have a non-Castro leading the country for the first time since the communist Cuban Revolution of 1959. We'll hear about how much damage communism has done to Cuba over the past six decades and what we can expect to happen next. We also have two more reports from our Trumpet staff. First, an update on the Iranian nuclear talks from Brent Noctegal from Israel. He tells us how Israeli officials are saying America under President Joe Biden is desperate to do a deal with Iran, and it is completely capitulating to the Iranian regime in these talks. And finally, we have a report from Richard Palmer about an ugly chapter in German and Catholic history, some secret documents that have just emerged that reveal how German intelligence services and Catholic officials hid notorious Holocaust planner Adolf Eichmann after the war, and how the State of Israel may have been involved in a secret deal behind the scenes to make this possible. But we'll start with my interview from last Friday with Dr. Dana Cheng, senior editor of China News for the Epoch Times, about the Chinese Communist Party. Well, we have Dr. Cheng via Skype from her office in New York. Hello there.
Hi.
Well, first, if you would, please tell us the reason the Epoch Times was founded in response to repression of the press by the Chinese Communist Party.
We started in year 2000. It was a time Chinese Communist Party was persecuting Falun Gong. And Falun Gong is a traditional meditation. It teaches five sets of exercises and teaches the principle of to be truthful, compassionate, and tolerant. And it was very popular in China. Between 70 to 100 million people were practicing. in China. Because of its popularity, Chinese Communist Party started to persecute it. Chinese Communist Party, we call it CCP, will not tolerate any group that is popular, because the CCP has always lived in fear. It's not a part of Chinese culture. It's a cloned system from Soviet Union. The ideology of a Communist Party is alien to people and is against the human nature. And during the Cultural Revolution, and actually since the beginning of communist ruling, it has destroyed the Chinese culture. So the party has always lived in fear. When they see something popular, they will crack down. And even if you are a jogging club or a tennis club or any club that get popular, or yoga, you will crack down. So it started to persecute Falun Gong. And during the persecution, they used the media to fabricate a story and days and lies to demonize the group, to justify the persecution. So it shows what's the function of the CCP-controlled media. And by the way, Chinese government, I should say CCP, openly said the media should be the mouthpiece of the party, the Communist Party. The department of that in charge of all the media is called Propaganda Department. Recently, because they need to communicate with the West and with the United States, they changed it to communication. But for a long history, it's called Propaganda Department. So all the media in China is state-owned or communist-owned. All the social media is monitored. The text or phone conversation are also monitored. That's how Chinese live. I grew up in China, and some of my friends, you know, we started this media together. They also grew up in China. We know how the media brainwash people. It has several functions. The CCP media has several functions. One, it lies. The purpose there is to lie, to mislead people, to follow communist ideology, to control. And second, it divides. And for a long time, it says, okay, the conflict, the problem of the society is because of a class difference. So the farmers, the peasants, the workers should overthrow the landlords or the business owners, the rich people. So it divides the country by class. But for 5,000-year history, China has a great history. Great civilization never had this class problem. So it's man-made, divided purposefully to use one group against another group. Well, here in America, it's a race card. But in China and Russia, it's like a class card. And it also have another function, is to silence others, to suppress other voice. So that's the function of the media. And we grew up there. We know we were cheated by those Chinese media. And at the peak of the persecution of Falun Gong, and we feel, okay, we need to have an independent media for Chinese people. They deserve it. We set up the media, the platform. Immediately, many Chinese people came to us, offered the news tips, contributed articles. We were immediate success. We immediately spread all over the world.
Mm-hmm. So you have websites now in 35 different countries. You're banned from mainland China, unsurprisingly. So the Chinese government obviously very opposed to your media organization. Maybe you could just talk, before we get into the specifics of what happened in the Hong Kong offices, you could just talk about the relationship that you've had with the CCP and how their opposition to the Epoch Times has manifested itself over the years.
Well, it's in any independent media, it's not going to be tolerated by Communist Party. And so when we started, actually, our first reporting and editor group was based in China. So they were reporting directly from China, human rights violation and the social issues. They were arrested within half a year. Mm. And some were sentenced to 3 to 5 years in jail, and some had been sentenced to 10 years in jail. That's a long time for reporting independently. Mm-hmm. Our staff in the West, our family members have been harassed in China. So we have always worked under pressure, but you know, that's what we face. And it's not easy to build independent media. The more the suppression, the more we feel, you know, it's something very worthwhile. Chinese people also, they are internet blockage. People inside China cannot access the internet outside China because the CCP want to control everything. But there are people who know how to get around the blockage, and they visit our website. Every day we have a large traffic from inside China. They trust us.
Yeah. So you have these offices in Hong Kong, and just tell us about this incident that occurred last Monday.
Well, on Monday, four intruders forced their way into the office and threatened the staff. You know, don't move, don't force us to take actions. And then they smashed the machine, they smashed the control panel, they took away the CPU. So we were temporarily forced to stop printing. Today, Friday, we repaired everything and we resumed printing on Friday. It's a big day for mm-hmm. us. This is the fifth time the printing press has been attacked. 2 years ago, in 2019, at the peak of the Hong Kong mass protest, mm-hmm. we were reporting what Hong Kong people really were doing and what they were fighting for. And of course, we were not following CCP's narrative. So four men got into the press office and set fire.
Oh, wow.
And fortunately, we put out those fire in time to rescue the printing press. So total, there were five times they were trying to damage the printing press. So it's a lot of pressure. There were only two independent media in Hong Kong. The other media called Apple Daily. The boss of Apple Daily is announced today. He was sentenced 14 months in jail. So that's the environment in Hong Kong, and that's a typical CCP-controlled environment for media.
So to this point, it seems that the Epoch Times has mostly faced harassment. You haven't been shut down permanently. You haven't had editors or reporters jailed. I'm assuming, maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, but you're dealing in an environment where they're very much trying to intimidate. One would assume that it would lead to worse suppression over time if nothing changes.
Right. Actually, our staff in Hong Kong, they have been monitored and followed. Their relatives in China have been threatened. So it's a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. But it means that it's very worthwhile. Readers support us. Readers really trust us. Mm-hmm. And Hong Kong people say, as long as Apple Times is there, we see hope.
Wow. Now, what's your view of the kind of moves that we see from the CCP recently? It seems like for a long time they had more concern over their image on the world stage, that they were trying to hide some of the worst aspects of their dictatorialism, especially outside of China. It seems like that is really changing in more recent years, and that it's becoming much more open in trying to silence opposition, such as, you know, this attack on the Hong Kong offices. What's your view of that change, and what would account for that?
Well, they have always tried to suppress our voice, and like in early stage, they even try to harass the advertisers and so that we won't have the financial support and harass our family members. So I think the nature of Communist Party has never changed. The Hong Kong situation, they are taking over Hong Kong, and basically Hong Kong people are losing their freedom and step by step. And right now is basically another city of China. And so they won't tolerate independent voice, and they have always a controlled voice in China. So that's not much, they have never changed. Well, with the opening to the West, with more and more trade with the West,
right,
people would hope that they will change, but actually they just changed the strategy. Their nature of deceit and control, that never changed. They actually want to change the world. They want to change the world, not the other way around. And Communist Party always feel that the free world is a threat, because that ideology just is against human nature. So any normal society is a threat. So they have always seen America as the number one enemy. That has never changed.
Yeah. Now it seems like we're seeing two kind of a contradictory trends going on. In one sense, you see this exposure of the Chinese Communist Party and the real intent of the CCP in a lot of nations. I think a lot of Americans are waking up to just how significant the threat is. But at the same time, you have China forging these very strong trade deals with many nations, with European nations, with Britain, other nations that are really, it's almost like they recognize that China is ascendant to the point where they need to be forging those kinds of relationships, economic and even political relationships with China, where they don't seem to be allowing concerns over human rights or some of the authoritarian tendencies that China is demonstrating to get in their way. When you look at the big picture of just how strong China is becoming and how even nations that have been champions of more of the democratic social order are going along with it, what is your perspective on China's future?
Well, China thinks, or CCP thinks, it's an equal power as America now.
Yeah.
So a few weeks ago, there was a meeting in Alaska. So two countries met,
right,
and this Chinese delegate basically, you know, lectured America in front of the world for 17 minutes without translation. Just keep lecturing America. It is to show that we are your equal, we are power, and you can't do anything to us. So they think they want their way, they are powerful enough that the world depend on the manufacturer and the trade with China, and nobody, you know, they want to have their way. And they think they are powerful enough to counter America now. What happened, like, in Taiwan, they are trying to pressure Taiwan, is to test how determined U.S. is to counter the expansion of communist regime.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to test America.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to argue with the fact that they have certainly put themselves in a position to be able to challenge America, that there are a lot of ways that America has shown itself unwilling to take the kinds of stands to prevent this from taking place. And then at the same time, you have other nations that really seem to be very much encouraging this kind of ascendancy from China. I think it's almost like they see which direction the wind is blowing and they feel like it's better to be on China's side than to make themselves an enemy.
Many countries are afraid of CCP.
Right.
And some countries want to see who would win, U.S. or China, and they don't want to get hurt But between free world and communist regime, everyone has to choose.
Yeah, that's true. And sadly, I think there are many people that are making the wrong choice in that. Before we finish, I just want to get your thoughts on what's happening to the press in America right now. Given your perspective, having seen the way that the Chinese Communist Party operates and the way it controls the press, we're at a important inflection point in America regarding freedom of the press. There's been a lot of evidence of really what is a lot like propaganda and the mainstream press promoting a leftist political agenda rather than performing its traditional role of objective reporting. I think this is driving a lot of people to organs like the Epoch Times. I imagine that you've seen your audience increase quite a lot here over the past couple of years. And there are also moves of suppressing certain truths. What's your view of what's happening in America's media, given your perspective of what has happened in China?
I think the mainstream media function more like a bigger corporation and a propaganda tool than independent media. In the past, America have a lot of independent media. Right now, most of the media have been consolidated into big corporation, and the way it run, it's more and more similar to the media in communist countries. Sadly, it doesn't report truthfully, it mislead people, and a lot of time it divide people, and it suppress other people's voice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why readers, they are wise. They want to choose independent voice. And that's why we got very popular in the last few years. We got very popular. And every day we get readers' letter encouraging us and thanking us. And many people tell us, you are the only news source I go to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have certainly come to appreciate the reporting of the Epoch Times more in the last year. But what is your view, Dr. Chang, of how the dangers, I guess, of Americans going along with communism, the way that this has infiltrated our universities, our education system? The media seem to be very, I would say, ignorant of the realities of communism. Can you just talk about that for a bit?
Well, it's shocking to me, and it's sad, and to notice that American people lack the understanding of communist. Although America has fought with Soviet Union for a long time, but it's almost like a fight in fishing, and the people feel communist is very far away.
Mm-hmm.
But communist is in our backyard. It's already in our living room. It's everywhere here. I left China because it's a communist regime. The day I left China, my professor sent me off at the airport. His last word is, never come back. This
wow.
is a communist place. Never come back. We came here for freedom. I never thought communists would follow me to America. In a lot of ways, America are becoming more and more like China, not the other way around. We hoped China would become America. And that's very dangerous. I know I have a lot of American friends. They are homebody. They love this land. They think what happened in China and the communists is something very far away. It has nothing to do with them. But it has everything to do with our daily life. We are surrounded by the product from China. We get a virus. Our economy got shut down, right? So whatever happened in China has everything to do with our daily life.
That's
the Midwest is no longer the same Midwest when I first came here. I love people in Midwest. They are good at manufacture. They invent a lot of machines. And if I visit my friends in their garage, everyone know how to do some like a special tool or machine. And now it's totally gone.
Yep.
And it's sad. And it's because of China. If Chinese people get rich and they have a better life, that would be okay. But we empowered a communist regime, and communist regime is going to take over America. That's their number one goal. That's how we were educated when we were little. They have never changed.
Well, it's a chilling warning. I really appreciate you speaking from the heart to our listeners.
What I see, like the protest and the Antifa, is the same as the Cultural Revolution in China. And this talking about the racism is the same as class struggle. It's the same. Just use one group against another group, divide the society. It's agenda driven. You know, for us, I see this. We have gone through all this in China. But to America, it's like people are still confused. That's communism has failed in every country, and now it's coming to America. And it's very sad. This is the last footage for free word.
We certainly appreciate you coming on and sharing your perspective with us. We've been talking with Dr. Dana Chang, senior editor of China News for the Epoch Times, about China and its increasingly repressive and authoritarian tendencies, particularly with respect to its dealings with the press. Really fascinating trend that is taking place here. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Chang.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Cuba has been under communist rule from Fidel and Raul Castro since 1959. But that era ended last week, as we will now hear in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
On April 16th, 2021, one of the last chapters of the Cold War had finally come to a close. Raul Castro retired from his post of First Secretary of the Communist Party of Cuba, the most powerful position in the country. He is succeeded by Miguel Díaz-Canel, Cuba's president and Castro's longtime protege. This would mark the first time since the Cuban Revolution in 1959 when Cuba has been ruled by somebody other than Fidel and Raul Castro. What does this mean for the island country? First, let's consider where the Castro brothers' legacy has left Cuba. The Cuban Revolution overthrew dictator Fulgencio Batista in 1959. Since then, the Castro regime has transformed Cuba into a communist state. Prior to the communist takeover, while Cuba had a dictatorial political structure, the economy was really good. Cuba had the fifth highest per capita income and third highest life expectancy in the Western Hemisphere, as well as having the second largest per capita ownership of vehicles and telephones, and had the largest number of television sets per inhabitant. It had the lowest mortality rate in Latin America. It spent more on education than did the United States, and had more doctors per 1,000 people than the United Kingdom. Cuban society was by no means perfect. Many Cubans struggled with poverty and, like in Cuba's northern neighbor, racial segregation was mainstream. But, especially compared to the rest of Latin America, Cuba was relatively well off. That changed once Fidel Castro, Raul Castro, Che Guevara, and others took over. Practically all business and agriculture was nationalized. Wages and employment levels were set by the government. Food and other goods were rationed. The government took most of people's savings. Following the model of the Soviet Union, Cuba became the first communist country of the Western Hemisphere. What are the fruits of that transformation? Since the revolution, Cuba's GDP per capita has risen at an average of only 1% per year. Roughly 2 million people have fled the country. Despite having incredibly fertile soil, the country has to import two-thirds of its food. To keep the economy functioning, Havana had to rely on generous subsidies from the Soviet Union. With the collapse of the USSR in the 1990s, Cuba's economy shrank by a third. It then had to turn to the new socialist government in Venezuela for financial support. With the Venezuelan economy currently in shambles, that is ending as well. The Cuban intelligence services were modeled after the Soviet KGB and are compared to the East German Stasi for ruthlessness. Legal emigration is heavily restricted. All political parties, other than the Communist Party, are banned. Religious minorities are heavily monitored. Nuclear war almost started because of events in Cuba with the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Fidel Castro's daughter even defected to the United States and became an anti-communist activist. This is the legacy of Fidel Castro's Cuba. As the 21st century progressed, Fidel Castro got older and older. In what was perhaps a Freudian slip, he told a reporter with The Atlantic in 2010 that, quote, "The Cuban model doesn't even work for us anymore," unquote. The statement was quickly elaborated to mean that the system needed some tweaking. We won't know for sure what Castro meant. In declining health, Fidel Castro resigned as first secretary in 2011, handing over the reins to his younger brother Raul, who had been the number two man in government for decades. Raul Castro was more open to changing the system. He approved limited experimentation with private enterprise and allowed expat Cubans to return to the country for short visits without retribution. But Raul Castro remains a committed socialist. The economy remains centralized, and the Communist Party the only legal political party. 2014 was a pivotal year. After 18 months of secret negotiations mediated by the Vatican, Raul Castro and United States President Barack Obama announced that Washington and Havana would normalize relations. This would be the first time the two countries would have normal relations since 1961. While the embargo wasn't officially removed, America and Cuba exchanged embassies, and Obama visited Cuba in 2016. Investment and travel restrictions were heavily loosened. Americans could now visit Cuba as tourists and bring American dollars with them. It is suspected that, given Cuba's economic situation at the time, a continued hard embargo would have caused the Castro regime to collapse. Obama's opening up with Cuba could have saved the Castro regime. But while communist Cuba was experiencing a revitalization, Raul Castro wasn't. Now in his 80s, he made preparations for his retirement. Castro retired from the post of president in 2018 while still holding on to the position of first secretary. His replacement was his protege, Miguel Díaz-Canel. Not much is known about Díaz-Canel. Unlike some other Cuban figures, he has managed to stay out of the spotlight for most of his political career. He was born in 1960, the year after the revolution. All he's ever known is the communist system. He was seen as a rising star in Havana, working his way to becoming Raul Castro's first vice president. Since becoming a high-profile politician, Díaz-Canel has tried to rebrand his image as a reformist. During fuel shortages in Cuba, he rode his bike to work instead of driving. He defended a gay club from protesters. He's advocated for giving Cubans easy access to the internet, something they historically haven't been able to have. He's, in short, portraying himself as a man of the people. And while he's 61, he provides a much younger face for Cuba compared to the Castros. Yet he is still an ardent socialist and has no intentions of abandoning Cuba's current system. In a leaked video, he claimed that Cuba has no obligations to commit to the terms of its deal with President Obama. He was stationed in Nicaragua in the 1980s to help support the socialist regime there. Guillermo Fariñas, a famous Cuban dissident, said that Mr. Díaz-Canel, quote, was very active, very militant, and very unconditional in his loyalty to the regime, unquote. So, what can we expect now that Miguel Díaz-Canel is first secretary? We can expect him to take a similar approach to Raúl Castro, an extremely limited opening up of the economy to keep Cuba afloat, all the while keeping the communist system more or less intact. But rather than an old guard revolutionary at the helm, we can see a younger man of the people portraying himself as open to new ideas. In other words, we can expect Díaz-Canel to take Cuba down the route Russian President Vladimir Putin took his country down, an iron-fisted regime with a facade of freedom and prosperity. But with Díaz-Canel's reformist image, we could potentially see countries in the West more eager to warm ties with Cuba. What would this mean for America? Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury was extremely critical of the Cuba deal set up by Barack Obama. He wrote in his free book, Great Again, quote, "Will this re-engagement change the nature of the Cuban regime? Cuba remains a terrorist-sponsoring nation to this day. In those diplomatic negotiations, Cuba made no concessions. It got everything it wanted from its enemy, the U.S., and gave nothing. Cuba has a recent history with Russia in designing a nuclear attack against America. Couldn't Cuba join with another world power to complete that design?" Unquote. Cuba remains no friend to America, and a hostile power could take advantage of Cuba's proximity to the American mainland as a way to lay siege on the United States. But with somebody like Miguel Díaz-Canel giving Cuba a new image, Washington might see Havana as being more innocuous than before, and might not see the danger that Cuba is putting on America until it is too late. To learn more, request your free copy of Great Again, available at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The desperation of America's current president to forge a deal with Iran is on full display in nuclear talks taking place right now, as we will now hear in this report from Brent Noctegal.
The nuclear talks currently underway in Vienna are leading to a complete American capitulation to the Iranian regime. That's according to Israeli officials briefed on the substance of the talks. On Monday, Israel's security cabinet met to discuss the ongoing war against Iran to slow their nuclear weapons program, as well as the direction of the renewed nuclear talks taking place in Vienna. Although Israel is not involved in the talks directly, it's reasonable to assume Israel knows exactly the details of the negotiations. And Israel is not impressed. According to one unnamed official present at the briefing, the Biden administration's, quote, goal is racing toward an agreement no matter what. He added, it's not a situation in which the Americans want to stand their ground. They're giving up more than the Iranians are asking for. The Iranians know the deal will be signed no matter what, so they're doing their most to maximize their gains, end quote. Israel Hayom reported more of the details of the shape of the agreement. Quote, according to information received by Israel, the six world powers, the United States, China, Russia, Great Britain, France, and Germany, and Iran, are indeed close to signing an agreement stipulating that the sides are returning to the original nuclear deal from 2015, from which former US President Donald Trump withdrew in 2018. However, Iran will not be required to destroy the new advanced centrifuges it has built, rather just disconnect them. Israel Hayom continued, the world powers are also expected to ignore other violations that are difficult to reverse from a technical standpoint. The Americans have also accepted in principle Iran's demand for compensation over the economic damage caused by the Trump administration's decision to withdraw from the deal. A compensation mechanism still doesn't exist and will likely be indirect once established. However, quote, the fundamental decision to restore the nuclear deal has already been made. End quote. This Israeli reporting confirms what was already increasingly obvious, that the Biden administration wants to find any way back into the flawed 2015 nuclear deal, a deal that puts Iran on a legal pathway to a nuclear weapon and removes financial sanctions crippling the regime. Reports of these concessions to the Iranians came just a couple of days after Iran increased its hand in nuclear blackmail against the West. As of Friday night, Iran reported that it had officially enriched uranium to 60% purity. In a joint statement released last Wednesday, France, Germany, and the United Kingdom said, quote, this is a serious development since the production of highly enriched uranium constitutes an important step in the production of a nuclear weapon. Iran has no credible civilian need for enrichment at this level, end quote. This is the highest level of purity Iran has ever achieved. There is no use for 60% uranium other than being a stopping point en route to 90% purity, which is the generally accepted level needed for a nuclear weapon. Ex-Deputy General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Olli Heinonen, told the Times of Israel that this means, quote, Iran could theoretically create weapons-grade uranium within a week, though not necessarily enough for a nuclear bomb. And yet, as Iran races towards getting weapons-grade uranium, the Biden administration is finding a way to sign a deal that returns billions of dollars towards Iran and lifts the suffocating Trump-era sanctions. Naturally, such a deal will come with the promise from the Iranians that they are not interested in nuclear weapons and that they will reduce their stockpile of now highly enriched uranium. It will also come with the promise that the Iranians will disconnect, not destroy, their underground, secretly stored, highly sophisticated next-generation centrifuges. Jacob Nagel and Mark Dubowitz of the Foundation of Defense of Democracies characterized the progress of the negotiations this way. The Iranian strategy is clear. Wield the threat of nuclear escalation to extort massive economic concessions in the form of American sanction relief and a return to the nuclear deal. In their opinion, America was played by the Iranians in the 2015 nuclear deal, and quote, another diplomatic collapse is coming, end quote. No wonder Israel is working overtime through leaks in the press to blow the cover on the deal before it's signed. According to Herb Kenyon of the Jerusalem Post, there is a purpose for the leaks. It's not to dissuade the Biden administration from completely capitulating to the Iranians with a new deal. That ship has already sailed. First, it's to reach out to Israel's remaining friends in Congress and to encourage them to pressure the Biden administration to halt the deal. This follows a similar logic to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 2015 speech before Congress immediately before the Obama-era deal was signed. Second, Kenyon believes that Israel is publicly decrying Biden administration's nuclear surrender to Iran in order to reinforce its alliance with Arab states. Quote, to let the Gulf countries know that they can continue to count on Jerusalem to lead the charge against a return to the JCPOA, even at the risk of once again incurring the administration's displeasure, end quote. Now, both of these reasons underlay a new reality in the Middle East that few are willing to face. That is, that the United States is purposefully empowering Iran at the expense of its traditional allies through the nuclear deal. This new reality shows that the United States is not on the same team as Israel and the Gulf states. It also shows that the United States is at all costs willing to give diplomatic and financial cover to the fanatical Iranian regime as it marches onward in its overt nuclear weapons program. What has motivated the drastic shift in American foreign policy? Why is the United States actively supporting its historic enemies while turning its back on its allies? Searching for a rational reason for such a turn will be fruitless. Instead, you need to read Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory's revealing article, The Barack Obama Mystery. There is no way of understanding America's current irrational foreign policy without the biblical understanding contained in that article.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Did the State of Israel actually help one of the architects of the Holocaust escape from Germany after World War II? We'll look at the evidence in this report from Richard Palmer.
It is now well documented that Germany's post-war government was thoroughly infiltrated by Nazis. It's also well known that these Nazis helped their more notorious colleagues to escape. But the Times of London has recently given us a much better picture of the role the State of Israel played in this post-war cover-up. On May 11, 1960, Israeli agents captured the infamous Holocaust organizer Adolf Eichmann and brought him to Jerusalem to face trial. It was a nerve-wracking time for Berlin. The CIA reported that Chancellor Konrad Adenauer's government was following the Eichmann trial with growing apprehension, sometimes bordering on hysteria. The Foreign Ministry State Secretary said it was quite possible that incriminating material against employees of the federal and state governments will come to light. Freelance journalist Gabriel Weber said that Germany was worried about the trial because Eichmann was like a walking bomb because he knew so much. And if he spilled the beans, he would have sent quite a few people into a spin. They were concerned for some good reasons. For years, Weber has fought a legal battle over the German government's files on Eichmann. And about 10 years ago, she forced the German intelligence service to publish some of the material that they had. And they showed that Germany's intel service helped Eichmann escape from a prisoner of war camp. And then the Catholic Church helped him flee to Argentina. So Germany knew for years where Eichmann was. So did the CIA. And they were terrified that Israel would reveal all of it in the Eichmann trial. Israel didn't. And there's always been a bit of a question mark as to why a lot of those details didn't come out. Well, now we know. The post-war German government was so concerned that they sent an undercover agent to act as Eichmann's lead defense lawyer. This lawyer helped keep certain names out of Eichmann's territory. And one of these key names was Hans Globke. He wrote the definitive handbook on the anti-Semitic Nuremberg laws, and his guidelines on how to apply the laws were spread all around Europe, and these guidelines were very anti-Semitic. During the war, Globke traveled all across Europe, drawing up new laws to strip Jews of their property and issue guidelines on how to identify, quote, lesser races. But Hans Globke got away with it. He was freed by the Allies in 1945. In 1949, he became a top advisor to Comrade Adenauer. He worked for the German government, working with Reinhard Gehlen, a former Nazi spymaster who set up Germany's post-war intelligence service. And Gehlen used to spy on German politicians and pass that information on to Globke. Globke also helped restore back pay and pensions to civil servants who had served the Nazis. And from 1953 to 1963, he was Adenauer's chief of staff. The Times called him the true architect of modern Germany. For Eichmann to drop his name, among many others, as one of his key helpers in the Holocaust would have been deeply embarrassing for the German government. So they stopped it coming out in court that their defense lawyer that was secretly in the pay of the government edited that name out of Eichmann's testimony. They pressured the CIA to remove Globke's name from Eichmann's memoirs. But Eichmann was in Israeli custody. How could they stop the Israelis from publishing those details? Well, Der Spiegel reported 10 years ago that Germany dangled hopes of much-needed military aid and weapon sales in exchange for Israeli cooperation over Eichmann. The Times claims that actually the deal was even bigger. Their recent report states that Germany went nuclear. They said that in the months before Eichmann's trial, Globke and Ardenia worked on a secret deal to lend Israel 2 billion Deutschmarks, that would be about 5.5 billion US dollars, for a, quote, developmental project in the Negev desert. And given that Israel spent 9 months preparing for Eichmann's trial, it's likely that the deal began shortly after he was captured. The Times reported the files released to Weber suggest this was in fact the atomic research facility and heavy water reactor at Dimona, the cradle of Israel's nuclear weapons program that these were talking about. They quote a memo from the German foreign minister regarding a meeting between the then German defense minister Franz Josef Strauss and Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. The memo states that Ben-Gurion addressed the problem of atomic weapons. In the conversation, Ben-Gurion explained that the Chancellor had promised him Germany would take part in the development of the Negev desert. Another foreign ministry document says that in no event can we make any undertakings before the conclusion of the Eichmann trial, implying that Germany's help with the nuclear program was in exchange for Israel's cooperation over Eichmann. The Times says that another file, quote, suggests that the US president of the day, John F. Kennedy, who had met Globke in Bonn a few months earlier, was privately informed of the scheme a few weeks before his assassination in November 1963. But this isn't the only time Germany's assisted with Israel's nuclear program. The Times points out that Germany has supplied equipment to the nuclear physics department at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. More recently, in 1991, Germany agreed to fund and build two diesel submarines for Israel. So during the Gulf War, Israel had come under attack by Iraqi rockets that had been built in part with German technology. The submarines were an apology gift. Since then, Germany has subsidized the construction of several more Israeli submarines, and the two have a contract in place for Germany to build the next generation of these submarines to be ready by around 2027. Now, these Dolphin-class submarines built by Germany are believed to carry Israel's nuclear weapons. So to construct its nuclear deterrent, its last and most powerful line of defense, Israel has turned again and again to Germany. Now, here at The Trumpet, we've warned for years that Israel's peace process will soon fail and that in the ensuing crisis, Israel will turn to Germany. Hosea chapter 5 and verse 13 states that when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim, and by implication Judah too, to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. Yet he could not heal you nor cure you of your wound. The Gesenius Hebrew Chaldee lexicon defines the word wound as the pressing together, binding of a wound, hence used figuratively of a remedy applied to the wounds of the state. So it's talking about the cure is the wound. In Obadiah chapter 7, it uses the same Hebrew word that's used for wound here to describe a deceitful peace pact. Israel's peace process is its wound, and when that fact is exposed, this prophecy in Hosea tells us that Israel will turn to Germany. And they've already demonstrated this attitude. Its plans for what to do if the Jewish state were ever to be entirely wiped out relies on German technology. You know, the nuclear missiles on board German submarines would avenge Israel's death. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry talked about this wound in his April 2020 article, Will the Trump Peace Plan Bring Peace to Israel? And he says, wound in Hosea means bandage. It's as if a bandage is hopelessly applied to an open running sore. From the beginning of the peace process, the Jews have looked to men, often their enemies, for help, not to God. That is the unseen wound. So little trust in God, so much trust in their enemies. The real wound is a spiritual, a lack of faith in God. The Jews keep trying to heal themselves by making peace pacts. They were strong when they trusted God. The Israelis will see that their peace agreement with the Palestinians has failed. They really only see the effect of their wound, not the cause. That is why they turn to Germany for another peace pact, placing their trust in an even greater enemy. Once again, they will fail to trust God. This will lead to the worst disaster in the Jews' long history of suffering. That is where this peace plan is leading. So the fact that Israel would deal with former Nazis to build their nuclear program helps expose this wound. To learn more about the Bible's prophecies for the Jewish state and their only true hope for peace, please read our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Dr. Dana Chang, Mihailo Zekic, Brent Nachtigall, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from G.K. Chesterton. Brave men are vertebrates. They have their softness on the surface and their toughness in the middle. But these modern cowards are all crustaceans. Their hardness is all on the cover, and their softness is inside. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.